Hey guys, welcome to episode 6 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now in this episode, I interview John Hirschfield. John is a therapist working out of Baltimore in America, and he is the co-author of the Mindfulness Workbook for OCD. A lot of you have read it, a lot of you give me some incredible feedback on it, and I indeed used it myself, and it has wonderful advice. It neatly breaks down everything, and it also, or John also gets you to write down various thoughts, various exercises, so you're actually engaging with the self-help. John had amazing advice to share around mindfulness and its application towards OCD treatment. We go into depth in a lot of topics, which I think you'll find interesting. He's just released another book called When a Family Member Has OCD. It came out in December. I encourage you to check that out. But I hope you enjoy. I hope you learn something. If you do enjoy it, please leave a review on YouTube or on iTunes, and you can find it via The OCD Stories on iTunes. It's also on Stitcher. Enjoy, and I'll speak to you soon. My guest today is John Hirschfield. John is a psychotherapist who specializes in the treatment of obsessive compulsive disorder. He's the author of two books, The Mindfulness Workbook for OCD, if I got that in the camera, and When a Family Member Has OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories podcast, John.
Hi, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So what I always like to get the guests to do is, if they have an OCD story, is kind of delve into it and talk about it as in as much or as little detail as you want.
All right. You mean my personal OCD story?
Yeah, and then you can bring in your career as well.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting, this subject of talking about OCD and having OCD and being an OCD specialist therapist. I find more and more people talking about it because there's a lot of us, and some varying degrees of disclosure happens. There are people who are advocates and working very closely with the International OCD Foundation, and then there are those who, you know, are in the closet, so to speak, and, you know, sort of not really, you know, comfortable acknowledging them, their symptoms. And I find myself somewhere in the middle, because having OCD is certainly what got me into becoming an OCD therapist. Yeah. And at the same time, I'm very, I don't know what the right word is. I think I'm very, very proud of the work that I'm able to do. Yeah. And I don't want it to be a shtick like, oh, he's the OCD therapist with OCD. Yeah. You know, I want to be just a good clinician. And it happens to be an interesting story. And that I also have OCD, but that's not really my marketing pitch, yeah. You know. So all that being said, I have had OCD as far as I can remember. Probably, you know, earliest time I noticed what would now be called a symptom was probably around 6 or 5 or something like that. And it would come and go with varying degrees of difficulty, almost always in the covert ritual or mental ritual realm of things. I mean, I had a couple of physical things that I would do, repeating things and saying certain words and things like that. But mostly it was just, you know, what I sometimes call loud thinking, which is, you know, you become aware of a thought, something about it doesn't sit right with you, and you just keep spinning it around and around and around until it magnifies and starts to take up all the real estate in your head, and then it becomes the most important thing to you in the world. And then all of your efforts, you know, are put into trying to get rid of it.
Yeah.
You know, some people wash their hands and some people wash their minds. So I had a particularly rough go of it when I was 28, and kind of hit a wall. I had had some therapy. I had been on different medications, and had mostly decided that, you know, life was just sort of awful, and I just had to accept that it was awful and not really focus too much on trying to get better. But then, you know, when I got to a place where I just was really having trouble functioning, because I really was just completely stuck on this one thought and this one and need for reassurance about it and need to kind of, you know, put it in its place and get rid of it. So I went back, I went into therapy, kind of said, well, you know, it's what I have to do, and realized that this was the first time that I, you know, not only received what I would call cognitive behavioral therapy, but really took it seriously, because I was really thinking about how this was going to affect the rest of my life. I mean, the last time I had really been in therapy, I was a teenager, and it was kind of difficult for me to take it seriously because I was so dramatic about the whole thing. You know, life is suffering, and, you know, philosophically, I couldn't get around the idea that I could get better. And now, as an adult, it was, no, I have to get better.
Yeah.
You know, I want to do something with my life. I don't know exactly how it's going to pan out, but many of the things that I value, there's no way I was going to have them if my mental health was going to be this kind of an issue. So I really took it seriously, and I was lucky I had a clinician, a therapist who was, you know, very, had expertise in OCD and worked with OCD. And as I was getting better through doing the work, I started contributing to online support groups, the email-based Yahoo groups. And over time, more of my sort of complaining and whining about how hard therapy is or how hard it is to have OCD became more about hearing other people's stories, and really recognizing that I wasn't alone, that this is a sort of a world view, you know, a way to think, and that CBT really does work. And I started giving more advice and realizing, hey, this is something that feels really good. You know, I'm connecting with people and they're saying, you know what, maybe I should try CBT, or maybe I should take a look at this, you know, mindfulness concept. And that felt really good. And it was a combination of all those factors, me getting better and me really connecting with the online OCD community, that made me realize it was time to make a more drastic change. So I went to graduate school. As soon as I got out of graduate school, I got an internship working at a place that focused pretty much exclusively on OCD. Yeah. And then after that, I worked at UCLA for a bit in their pediatric intensive program, and then full-time private practice since. And cool. Very fortunate, very happy to do what I love to do. I saw on Facebook at this thing once. It was like a bunch of circles that weren't connected, and it said things I'm good at, things that make money, things that matter. I think there may have been a fourth one. I don't know, but they're all separate, you know. Yeah. And I was really, it made me really realize how blessed I am to be able to have all those things in one space.
Yeah, no, that's really great to hear. So what were you doing before you trained to go into therapy, to be a therapist?
I was an actor. Okay. So I mentioned before we started the interview that I lived in New York for 4 years. So I have a Bachelor of Fine Arts in drama from New York University. And then that's what took me out to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting industry. I mean, I worked, you know, I did commercials and a couple of guest spots on TV, and every once in a while, one of my clients will taunt me a little bit about some, you know, clip that they saw of me on YouTube or something like that.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's also pretty psychologically destructive. You spend most of your time being rejected, thinking you're not good enough. And then you spend a couple of days, a year, if you're lucky, you know, shooting something and thinking that you're the best and you've got your trailer and everything provided for you, you know, and everybody's being very nice to you. And to get paid to do what you love is a great feeling. But then as soon as you walk off the set, you know, if you don't have another job lined up, then you're nothing again.
Yeah.
And for someone with OCD, this is, you know, and prone to depression, this is particularly challenging to sort of keep your head up.
Yeah.
And I have no doubt that living that lifestyle, and this is by no means a judgment on my friends who continue to live that lifestyle, but for me, that lifestyle definitely contributed to what could only have been described as my wall, you know, my breakdown, where I just could not take anymore.
Yeah, that's a very uncertain lifestyle, right? And obviously, OCD hates uncertainty.
So. Yes. When you live with a disorder characterized mostly by a deficit in your ability to tolerate uncertainty.
Yeah.
It's better to have structure in your life than not have structure in your life.
Yeah, that's true. I think now that I'm well into recovery and I live a relatively normal life, for obviously use the word normal lightly, I'm trying to take more risks, because I think over the years OCD has played a huge part in how risk averse I am. Mm-hmm. And I think at times I miss out on opportunities because of that. So now that I'm in a better place, I can afford to take those risks a bit more. So I'm trying to force myself to do that.
Risk is an interesting thing with OCD. Mostly what you see is what you described, which is being sort of risk averse. Sometimes you see the opposite, though, where the aversion is to thinking, you know, because thinking and planning and preparing can cause a lot of suffering. And so sometimes people make impulsive decisions that might not be in their best interest, which I know I've done in my past, is sort of, you know, just committing to certain things because to try to decide what's really in my best interest would be too anxiety producing. So I'll just do that, you know. And sometimes that would work and sometimes it wouldn't.
That's good to hear. I occasionally can be impulsive. All right, so that I saw you did a talk for OCD Georgia. And that was a really interesting talk, and I'll link to that on the show notes of this talk. And I thought you were a good presenter, so that explains it now that you obviously trained in acting, and so you know how to command a stage. And
it's funny when you're an actor, and I had been acting since I was a kid, so it was the only thing I'd ever done, and it was the only thing I could imagine doing. And a lot of that, the culture of acting does that, where it's just sort of like, if you even think about having, you know, the day job or the backup plan, then you're some kind of, you know, you're not really passionate. You're some kind of a cheater, you know. And so deciding to become a therapist was not an easy decision. I mean, I fought myself the whole way. And I'm just really, really grateful that I, you know, relented because, you know, even entering graduate school, I was like, well, you know, but if I get like a, you know, spot on a show or something, you know, this would be the backup plan. Like I was interested in it, but I felt really ashamed. It felt like giving up.
Yeah.
But day one, first class graduate school, I was like, what's wrong with me? This is where I belong.
that's great to hear.
And I get to do a lot of improv and creativity and a lot of the things that I wanted to get to do in acting, I get to do it in therapy. Whereas mostly acting was, you know, like, buy this product. You know?
That's true. Yeah, there's more variety in it. All right, cool. So let's go on to mindfulness. Kind of a two-part question is, you know, most people are familiar, I guess, with mindfulness now, the concept of it. But assuming some people aren't, if you could just explain what mindfulness is, and then, I guess, more importantly, how mindfulness can be used to treat OCD.
Sure. I have an interesting relationship with mindfulness because I would argue that I practiced it and used it to help overcome my OCD challenges long before I ever heard the word. And it wasn't really until I was training and working as a therapist that I started using the word to describe what I was doing and what people need to do to get better. Mindfulness is, I think it's a couple of things. In its simplest form, it's observing your internal experience, your thoughts, your feelings, your physical sensations, urges, impulses, etc. Observing your internal experience without judgment and in the present moment.
Yeah.
Right. So it's not. So to be mindless would be to follow storylines. You know, go down the rabbit hole every time you get an idea. And to be mindful would be to watch the storyline appear and think, you know, that's an interesting story and kind of make a decision about how much attention you're going to give to it.
Yeah.
So a lot of people think of mindfulness as not thinking. It's not really true. It's not thinking without awareness that you are thinking.
Yeah.
It's not mindlessness.
Okay.
So the ability to observe your internal experience without judgment in the present moment. And then more specifically for OCD, the ability to make a choice to let something be where it is and return your attention to the present moment, regardless of what you're feeling or thinking.
Yeah.
So it's, on one level, it's a way of looking at things, an observer, a spectator. Yeah. And on another level, it's a way of doing, which is, you know, gently guiding your attention back to the moment, back to the present moment. So meditation is one way that you could practice this skill, because all meditation is you are pointing your attention to some anchor, like the breath is usually people do. And simply noticing when you've wandered away from that anchor, like, oh, look at that, you know, that's thinking or that's feeling or whatever, I've wandered off, and then bringing yourself back. And it's that sort of coming back muscle that people with OCD really struggle with, because they try, right? So I'm trying to let it go. I'm trying to not think these thoughts or to stop obsessing about this. But there's like a kind of a mental glue that keeps sucking them back into the storyline.
Yeah.
So if they could strengthen that part of the brain that allows them to sort of let that be there and let you be here, that's what I would call mindfulness.
Okay, brilliant. No, that's really helpful. So is that, do you advocate ACT as well, so acceptance and commitment therapy, or is mindfulness, do you consider it separate?
I think that the best way to understand it is that ACT is a ACT is great, by the way. And ACT is a form of cognitive behavioral therapy that has a certain protocol, has different interventions that they use, all in the service of a sort of philosophy of literally what it is called, accepting, right, and committing. And mindfulness is, I would say, is one of the interventions that's used in ACT. What I do more of, and I wouldn't really call myself an ACT practitioner, I don't have training specifically in ACT other than what I've read in books. What I do more of is probably best understood as mindfulness-based cognitive behavioral therapy. So it's very much focused on specific techniques for challenging distorted thought processes that lead to compulsions, very much focused on exposure with response prevention, and then using mindfulness, again, as a as an enhancement tool for improving people's ability to cognitively, you know, reframe their experience in a healthier way, or enable themselves to be in the presence of a discomforting thought or feeling the way you would during exposure therapy.
So I've got a user question off Instagram here from a lady called Emma. And firstly, before I get into the question, she said to say that your book was the first book she came to when she was doing self-help for OCD. And she said your book helped her the most. And she's now an advocate because of your book and because of the tools she learned within it.
Wow, that's
quite a good compliment.
Yeah, that's really touching. I love getting feedback like that because I'm incredibly vain, and also it means a lot to know that you know, people are out there getting better, because every one of them, you know, I mean, she's putting good things out into the universe as well, and so she's going to help people just by living a good life and demonstrating, you know, that you can actually live joyfully with OCD if you know how to operate this equipment, you know.
Yeah, that's very true. It's a ripple effect, isn't it? So she wanted to know, do you have any tips to stay on track with mindfulness training? Because obviously day-to-day life gets in the way, it's you're not motivated sometimes to do it there.
Yeah, sure. I'm still trying to get used to this idea that people relate to me as a mindfulness expert, because I think people who actually are mindfulness experts probably wouldn't think very highly of me, because they probably think of me as someone who, you know, kind of found mindfulness in a vending machine and thought it was like a neat toy. You know, I for me, mindfulness is a tool for you know, improving well-being overall, but my experience with it is specifically as a tool for improving OCD symptoms. So I'm not somebody who meditates for, you know, 3 hours a day. I haven't been on a 2-week retreat or something like that, silent retreat or anything like that. I mean, these things fascinate me, and perhaps one day I will, but I am more of the type to think that, you know, the value that I'm going to get from mindfulness here is, let's say, if I can commit to doing just 10 minutes a day of meditating, and that meditating is an exercise that I do to, again, strengthen that focus, that, you know, because I tend to wander off into scary story land, and if I can just notice that that's happened and bring myself back, the better skill I have there, the better I'll be able to manage my OCD. So to me, it's sort of like, you know, spending 20 minutes on a stationary bike or some other kind of, you know, hygiene or exercise. So how to stay on it, I found it's really helpful if you're just doing 10, 15, maybe 20 minutes of meditation and you really want it to be a regular part of your life, is you kind of have to trick yourself into thinking it's a part of some other activity. So you pair it with something that you're going to do more or less the same time every day. The best run that I've ever had with meditation, I think I meditated about, it was something like 200 days in a row. This was last year. And the reason I was able to do this is because I was working Sunday through Friday. I only had one day off at that time. And I would start pretty much at the same time every day. You know, so my first client was at 9, and I knew I wanted to have maybe 15 minutes to check my emails. So I would get there at 8:30 then, and 8:30 was when my day started. And the day started with, you know, 15 minutes of meditation, 15 minutes to check my emails, and then seeing my first client. And so it was all wrapped into the morning routine. It wasn't, I didn't have to remember to meditate. It was just what you do, like brushing your teeth before you go to bed. So I would suggest try to find something in your life that has that quality, where you're pairing it with something that you're going to do anyway, and so it doesn't feel so much like going to the gym. I mean, the hardest thing about going to the gym, right, is putting on your workout clothes and getting there. Once you're there, you're fine, but that sort of transitioning into it is really hard. And it's the same thing with meditation.
Yeah,
I would also say that you don't have to rely exclusively on meditation to practice mindfulness every day. You know, just take moments when it occurs to you, when mindfulness sort of pops into your head, and you go, oh, mindfulness, I kind of like that. Just listen to the song that's playing when you're driving in the car and listening to music, or turn the music off and just watch the road for a moment. You know, if you're eating and the word mindfulness pops into your head, just stop for a second and experience the flavor of the food that you're eating, instead of using eating as, you know, recharging your batteries while you think about your next work project, which is how most of us eat, right? Yeah. Mindlessly. So I would look for those mindfulness in the moment experiences, and you can create them pretty much at any time.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's really helpful, especially you said about getting the routine, because with meditation, if you don't have that routine, you're relying on willpower. And obviously, willpower is finite. And some days, if you're annoyed or you're in a heavy OCD spike, you're not going to have the willpower necessarily to sit down and meditate. But as you say, if you had that pattern, that schedule, you're more likely to see it through. The thing I found with mindfulness as well, as you said, you can practice it anywhere and any time. I do try and remember, as you said, because sometimes I do get the thought of mindfulness because I've read about it so much, so it does pop in. I try, and if I'm washing my hands, focus on the water, the feeling, etc., the sounds. But what I've found now is, like, kind of beyond OCD, it's a life skill that's benefited me greatly. Like, in no way am I an angry person, but I'm human, and occasionally I will get annoyed by something. And
that's the most British thing I've ever heard.
Yeah. Yeah, it could be quite reserved. But so what I do is, if I feel like I'm getting angry and then I'm running off on stories inside my head and dramatizing it, as you said, bad story land, if I remember, I will stop my thoughts for a minute and just observe the feeling, wherever it is in my chest or my body or my head. And as soon as I start to observe it, I almost completely forget, it almost seems absurd that I was angry, because I realized that there's no truth. It's just a feeling.
Yeah.
But it takes me, I've got to be lucky enough to capture that and diffuse myself from it long enough to be mindful of the emotion.
Yeah. Anger especially is one of those things where it's really just a lack of acceptance, right? Things are one way, but you want them to be another.
Yeah.
And you're not okay with it. And so the only way to cope with that is anger, if you're sort of in the middle of it, you know. It's just like, but it should be the way that I want it, but it's not the way that I want it. But I want it to be the way that I want it. As a, you know, and with mindfulness, you're able to observe, like, okay, I want it to be one way and it's another. And I can make some space for that. I think a lot of people confuse mindfulness with being okay with everything, though, with being relax and not experiencing anger. I mean, anger is, of course, a normal human emotion. It's not always bad. I think what mindfulness gives you is the ability to make a choice regarding, A, how much attention you're going to give your anger or whatever it is that's bothering you, and B, how you're going to respond to that anger. I had a client not too long ago tell me she was having a fight with her husband, and she remembered mindfulness, and she was really angry, and she said, okay, I'm mindful of how angry I am. And then she came to me in the next session, she's like, and that just made me more angry. So what was the point? And so, you know, the point is, rather than mindlessly following your anger into, you know, some unhelpful behavior, if you could just stop for a second and say, oh, hey, look at that, I'm angry. Now, do I want to take this anger and give myself a break and process why I'm in this conflict, and then maybe come back and talk to my husband about it, you know, and sort it out that way? Yeah. Or do I want to take this anger and, you know, pick up this plate and throw it at his face? It's your choice. You could do whatever you want, but the point is, it has to be a choice. And a lot of times, when we're just mindlessly following our emotions wherever they lead us, we find ourselves doing things that are not in line with our values, that aren't helpful. And then looking back and going, oh, I wish I hadn't done that, or, you know, I wish I had given this more thought. You know, I wish I had given myself a little bit more time to take it in. So mindfulness helps you respond rather than just react. But sometimes the response is not, you know, to be, you know, like Matthew McConaughey, like, you know, laid back on the beach or something like that. Sometimes the response is to take action. And but it should be your choice.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's a good point. Have you ever seen the film The Peaceful Warrior?
No.
Oh, it's really good. It's about a guy. It's a somewhat true story, but it's based on a guy who's like mentoring this American collegiate athlete, and I'm not describing this very well. The mentor's like this old wise Buddha type character, and basically he's telling this college kid to do all these weird things, and he's like, "You're out of your mind," and he's like, "Yeah, it's taken me a whole lifetime." I really like
that's
that.
That's great. I always attributed this. I'm pretty sure he's the first one to say it. There's an OCD therapist, Dr. Jim Claiborne. In fact, he wrote the foreword for the mindfulness workbook, and he's very active on one of the discussion boards that I come to sometimes. And he told someone once, he said, "What goes on in my mind is none of my business." And I think that's a very useful thing to remember because we get so impressed by our thoughts when they feel threatening to us, you know, and so amazed by our feelings, when in fact that's not necessary. You know, thoughts don't have to be threats. Feelings don't have to be facts. They could just be things that you observe, and you can make a choice in how you want to respond to them.
Yeah, that's a brilliant quote. Oh man, I'm gonna steal that and use that.
Yeah, it's a good one.
I'll quote it. Okay, so I know you said you weren't a mindfulness expert in the traditional sense of mindfulness training. From a meditation point of view, are there any good meditations that you'd recommend for, let's say, someone listening has no experience, has never meditated in their life? What's kind of a basic one to get them started?
There's two that I always recommend to my clients. And I usually just tell them, you know, after I've done a little education on mindfulness and meditation, I say, you know, try these two out, and whichever one feels more in line with your personality, just run with it. So one is called Headspace, which has become very popular recently.
Yeah.
And what I like about Headspace is it's very warm and inviting, and it really does approach meditation from a similar perspective that I need it to come from. Mm-hmm. So you could take it and you could expand it into this broader, larger philosophical thing, or you could take it and just use it as an exercise, as a form of mental hygiene, which is really my primary use for it. The other stuff is to me is icing. You know, it's like, wow, my worldview is better as a result of being a more mindful person.
Yeah.
But as a clinician and as somebody who's trying to help people with OCD, I want to know that is this an exercise that really, if they use it, will it have an effect in their behavior? And Headspace is really good at breaking it down into, you know, here's what you do. And you can do it, you know, in these nice little 10-minute blocks, which is useful. And then if you want to do more, you can increase it. And it doesn't have, there's a lot of meditation apps out there. And again, this is a personality thing. It's just, it's not for me, but maybe it's for others, you know, that are very lofty and very, you know, be one with the universe. And they have this sort of subtle implication that if you're not, you know, floating a few inches above the ground when you're done, then you've done something wrong, you know. And that's not the purpose that this exercise has for me and my clients. So I really like the way he explains meditation, because even though he never, and I'm talking about Andy Puddingcombe, the guy who runs Headspace, he never says OCD. But he could be talking about OCD. It's that good. The other one is 10% Happier. It's an app that was created by Dan Harris and his meditation teacher, Joshua Goldstein. And Dan Harris wrote a book of the same name, and it was about his experience discovering mindfulness after having had a panic attack on the air. He's a reporter for, I think it was ABC.
Yeah.
And it's a much simpler program, but it's a similar concept. They're sort of short meditations. They teach you how it's done, and before each meditation is an interview between Dan Harris and his meditation teacher, where he asks the kind of questions that we all want answers to, like, well, you know, what is the point of all this, and you know, how is this going to make me feel, and what if I'm doing it wrong, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So that's another good one. And, you know, it just has a slightly more skeptical tone to it, you know, almost like it knows that a person approaching this might be suspicious of meditation as some kind of iffy-dippy thing, you know, and it kind of addresses that in a way that I think is good.
Yeah, no, I really like that. Okay, yeah, I mean, Headspace massively helped me. That was, I mean, I was in recovery for about a year, but I had kind of beaten every other subtype of OCD. Obviously, it's all OCD, but I hadn't, relationship OCD was kind of figuratively killing me at the point. And and I knew I had to start meditating. And I got the Headspace app, and I, after about 2 weeks of doing it consistently, I noticed an improvement. And as you said, when you said about Andy Puddicum could be talking about OCD, and it's, yeah, the first, you know, five, six sessions, just everything he said, it was like, it's almost, yeah, as if he is talking to me specifically. And it's, it's free the first 10 sessions as well. So,
it does have this quality that I quite like. And so does 10% Happier, but Headspace maybe a bit more so, where you're in the middle of the meditation and you start to think, I can't get control of my attention, you know, I'm wandering all over the place. I can't stop thinking. And then, you know, you kind of forgot that he was there. And then all of a sudden he pipes up, you know, with his nice voice. And he's like, you might be thinking that you're thinking too much. That's perfectly all right. You know, could just come back, you know, begin again. And it's like, oh, okay. Yeah, good. You know, it was almost like, somehow he knew I had wandered off.
It's like he's watching.
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Cool. So I'm just checking for the next question. Okay, so actually on meditation, a question I've had a lot when I've recommended it to people is they come back and say, you know, when I sit and meditate, I just get so many intrusive thoughts and it's scary and it's painful. You know, and then they say, like, you know, I can't meditate.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of like, you can just sit with it. You have to accept it. And it's easier said than done. But for those people who find it extremely hard to meditate, is there anything you can recommend to help them stick with it?
Well, yeah, I mean, first of all, they're right, because their definition of meditate is to perform really, really well at not thinking, and they cannot do that, you know. So, you know, people with OCD, you know, they're a little bit cooler than the rest of the population. They know, you know, a little bit more of what's going on inside, and that's why they're naturally, I think, a little bit more more skeptical of meditation, right? Because you get this idea that it's like you're going to sit down and clear your mind.
Yeah.
You know, and my first instruction is always, whatever you do, don't clear your mind. You know, leave your mind exactly the way it is. That's what you're learning how to do. Let your mind be as full of junk as it needs to be. And all you're trying to do is, over time, decrease the amount of time it takes you to notice that you're not paying attention to the thing you said you were going to pay attention to. Yeah. And not in a punitive way, like, what's wrong with you? Why aren't you thinking about your breath? In just a very basic, like, oh, that's happening kind of way. So you're paying attention to your breath, and you're breathing in, and you're breathing out, and you have to return that pair of socks to the store because, you know, they don't really match your pants, and but you hate returning things because it's embarrassing. Wait a second. I wandered off there. Let me get back down. I'm breathing in and I'm breathing out. And that's all you're doing. Yeah. And you're just getting more habituated to that way of relating to your thoughts. But you just pick up on it. You go, oh, that's thinking. And then you come back. And what happens in the exercise is, in my opinion, largely irrelevant. If at the end you feel more relaxed, well, sure, you just sat for 10 minutes and breathed. You should probably feel more relaxed. Yeah. But if you don't, that's okay too. What I'm more interested in is later in the day when you you know, are worried about getting a disease and you think you may have touched something that was contaminated, but you're really on your way to go do something that you care about and you get completely distracted by that trigger, how long is it going to take you before you recognize, oh, right, I've been triggered. This is what happens when I get triggered. Okay, well, I'm having lots of thoughts and that's fine, but kind of in the middle of something right now and getting back to the thing that you'd planned to do before you got distracted.
Yeah.
That's when the meditation really starts to make a difference.
Yeah.
But the But the issue with those of us with OCD is that as soon as we sit, we do get pulled from our anchor by, 10,000 hands. And part of it has to do with this way of always being evaluative, meaning, am I doing a good job or am I doing a bad job? And and that's not how mindfulness thinking works.
Yeah.
There is no good meditating or bad meditating. If you have to address the fact that you've wandered off 1,000 times or 10 times, it doesn't make a difference, because it's just, that's the exercise. You're training in noticing differently.
Yeah, I think as we're as a sort of Western society, we're trained to be success minded and to achieve, and meditation's not about achieving, it's just about being, isn't it? And I think that's what we find hard, maybe everyone, not just people with OCD, anyone who meditates.
Well, and people with OCD also struggle with sitting comfortably in the middle ground, right? Mm. So they either want to not do something or they want to do it very well. And there is something intrinsic about mindful philosophy that is at odds with Western, what we would call Western philosophy, with our Western culture.
Yeah.
And I don't think that has to be a problem. I think it just has to be kind of owned. I often tell my clients a good way to understand mindfulness is, your brain is like the hard drive of a computer that's full of data, and it's presenting information to a screen. So like right now, you and I are doing Skype, and literally we're both looking at this screen. And I like to think of the mind as actually being more stationary. A lot of times you hear about the mind being active, and it's doing this, and it's doing that.
Yeah.
I like to think of the mind as it's just showing you what's going on in the brain, and you're the one who's being active. So I'm looking at you in the screen right now,
And
I see your face, and I see the things behind you. But then behind that, because Skype doesn't take up the whole monitor, I also see that there's some email in the background, there's icons at the bottom. It's actually a lot going on in front of me right now.
Yeah.
But my focus is on you, and it's a choice that I'm making.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a choice that I can make because I'm back here. And if my face was like pushed up against the screen and all I could see is the rim of your glasses, then that would be the only thing that I'd be able to attend to.
Yeah.
So mindfulness is very much about noticing that you are not the screen. When you have a thought about being dirty and you feel dirty as a result, that's a problem of being too close to the screen. If you back up, you can now see that, over here is a thought about being dirty. That's worth X amount of attention. Over here is a thought about what I'm going to have for lunch, and that's worth a different amount of attention. And you're just making these choices. People who meditate for hours on end and really devote their lives to it, those who are seeking what we would call enlightenment, what they're trying to do is get so far from the screen that they cease to exist. That's what enlightenment really means, is the loss of self.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful thing. But I like my, video games too much to worry about that. That's a completely different way of life. I really respect it. But it's not my way of life. And so I'm not trying to become enlightened here. This is a good distance for me from the screen. And I just need to get, consistently develop greater mastery over noticing when I'm inching closer to the screen, and then I think I've become the screen. And that's the opposite of mindfulness.
Yeah. It's a cognitive fusion, right? When you're tied in with your thoughts. Yeah. Cool. Yeah, no, that's brilliant. I love that analogy as well. Sorry, I've laid out my questions terribly here because I can't. Okay, cool. Actually, before we kind of leave meditation alone, someone said to me on Twitter the other day, which I found interesting and you might, is you mentioned silent retreats earlier. And this guy said he suffered from OCD for a very long time, and he went and did a 10-day silent Vipassana. Did I say it right?
Vipassana,
Vipassana, that's it. Yeah, 10-day Vipassana retreat. And he said at the end of it, OCD barely bothers him anymore.
Wow.
And it was...
good for him.
Yeah, and I thought, obviously it might not work for everyone, but I found that a fascinating story. Cool. So how can mindfulness work alongside ERP?
So exposure with response prevention or exposure and ritual prevention and, however you want to put it.
Yeah.
I think it's very easy to overlook what the point of it all is. A lot of times it's, the focus is too much on, well, you're afraid of this, so you have to do it, and then you'll do it, and then you'll stop being afraid of it. And, you know, that's part of it, but it's actually a little bit more intricate than that. You have a problem with OCD in which you're repeatedly engaging in behaviors, mental or physical behaviors, that are aimed at increasing certainty and are viewed as a prerequisite for moving on. Like, I'll move on after I've washed my hands. You know, I'll move on after I figure this out. Yeah. And these behaviors are reinforcing the power of the obsession. And that's how people get stuck in this loop. The more you have the obsession, the more you do the compulsion. The more you do the compulsion, the more powerful the obsession becomes. So in cognitive behavioral treatment, we do have a goal in mind. And that's what I think traditional CBT differs a bit from ACT in this regard. And this is sort of ACT doesn't really claim to have, I think, the same kind of goals, trying to achieve certain things. ACT is more about trying to help that person clarify their values and make commitments based on that. And traditional CBT, although it has that element of it, it really does have a more specific goal, which is stop doing compulsions.
Yeah.
Now, how are you supposed to stop something that you're constantly, you know, being bullied internally into doing? You don't feel like you have any power over. And it's the only thing that gives you, seems to give you any sort of short-term relief. It's very difficult. So it's something that you're going to have to train in doing. You're going to have to practice it. So it's not enough to just sort of white knuckle your way through an experience when you've been triggered and like try not to do a compulsion. You actually have to have some skill in this area. Mm. And so ERP is really the practice of that skill. It's purposely bringing the thought or feeling or sensation to the forefront that you're grappling with. The one in which you have the greatest urge to compulse, right? Where, so we're trying to generate that urge to do compulsions so that you can practice not doing them, so that the brain is forced to recalculate its position that when you're in the presence of this thought, you must do this behavior. We want to have a lot of data in there that says, when you're in the presence of this thought, you could do this, you could do that, you could do nothing, that would be fine, right? We want the brain to believe that to be true, but it will only ever come to that conclusion if you stop doing compulsions.
Yeah.
So where mindfulness comes in is really in the heart of the ERP. When you're doing an exposure, you're actually purposely choosing a very uncomfortable feeling or thought or sensation or emotion as your anchor. So instead of the breath, it's what it feels like to think you're dirty and need to wash your hands, or what it feels like to think that you're at risk of suddenly losing your sexual identity, or what it feels like that you might be settling or you might be in the wrong relationship or something like that. Mm. And once you've really gotten in front of that feeling and sat there and experienced it, and then again, that's where the mindfulness is. It's, I am feeling this. I am aware of this. I'm having these thoughts. Oh, look at that. There I am with it. I'm not running from it. I'm not trying to change it. I'm not analyzing it to death. I'm just experiencing it. Then you give your brain some time to witness this and say, like, oh, wait, look at that. So that's really scary for him, but he didn't go wash his hands, you know, or that's really scary for him, but he didn't try to prove to himself that it wouldn't come true. So perhaps there's some space that can be made. We can, like, you know, rewire a couple of neurons here and there, and some space can be made for, I don't know, accepting uncertainty or not resolving this problem or allowing yourself to be in the presence of this problem without fleeing from the things you care about. So again, mindfulness is an enhancer of the ERP. It's not an alternative to it.
Yeah.
And I would also say that mindfulness is exposure in and of itself sometimes. You know, when you relate to something, to a trigger mindfully, you're basically doing exposure to your fear of not taking your thoughts seriously enough. Right? Oh, there's a thought about drowning my kid in the bathtub. But that's a huge exposure that you just did just by noticing that you had that thought and saying, okay, I had that thought. You know, so a lot of times I hear people refer to, you know, well, I don't really want to do ERP because that sounds awful, but, you know, mindfulness, I'd be willing to give a shot. But mindfulness is incredibly scary stuff. And it's just as, it is ERP, in my opinion. It's just a slightly different way of going about it.
Yeah, no, that's a fair comment. And actually, it ties in perfectly to my next question. Sorry, I drank my water way too quickly. I get a lot of questions either through YouTube or via email, and people say, you know, I recommend ERP to them, or they come to me and say they've tried ERP or they want to try it, but they're terrified. Are there any tips you have to, I guess, push people over that edge, so to speak, to get them to commit to ERP, either start it or go back and continue it?
Some of it just comes down to who it is that they're going to be working with. I mean,
Yeah.
there's a it's an unfortunate reality that there's a limited number of people who are trained in behavioral therapy at all, and then within that group that are trained specifically in OCD. And ERP done sloppily can make you pretty miserable without a lot of, progress. It could sometimes work sloppily, but mostly it needs to be done with the right ideas in mind. So the first thing is you want to make sure, if you can, that you're working with somebody who really knows OCD so that you can really trust them. And if you can't find somebody like that, if maybe you're using a self-help or workbook approach, carefully consider what workbook you're going to use, or what parts of it you're going to use, and maybe consult with people that you do trust. There's a lot of misconceptions about ERP. I mean, you get a lot of images in your head from sensationalized TV shows and things like that, of people eating out of the toilets and dumpster diving and watching a lot of gay pornography when they're not gay and things like that. And there really is a role for some of those more extreme exposures. But what I think gets overlooked is that when a person is doing that, they're doing it because that's really only a step above or a step apart from other work that they've been doing to get to that place. It's not like, day one you walk in and you say, I have a fear of being gay, and the therapist's like, hey, look at this. It's not quite like that. I think also you need to remember that there are rules to ERP. So if you remember what the point of it is to generate an urge to compulse so that you can demonstrate to your brain that you don't have to compulse in the presence of that trigger. And so there's a gazillion one ways to do it. And if you're following these guidelines, it's not about the hierarchy. It's about, is this really going to stand a chance of achieving the goal that I'm trying to achieve? If it's just going to freak the person out because it'll freak them out because you know that they hate it, but it's not actually going to turn into a learning opportunity, there's really no point to it. And so I like to talk to people about, we're never going to do something that's dangerous, that's going to hurt you, that violates your religious or ethical beliefs. I'm never going to ask a client to do something that I wouldn't do, which is kind of, there's a lot of things I would do, so that's pretty unfair. And I'm never going to ask them to do something I don't think that they're capable of doing, just to watch them squirm. I'm really interested in, is this going to get them better? And so a lot of times that has to do with walking the line of uncertainty around, are we going too far, or can I handle this? Especially with religious obsessions, I find that, reasonably so, my religious clients are concerned that I might be pushing them into sin, and they don't want, or blasphemy, and they don't want to do that. And I'm more interested in saying, well, how close to the line between sin and not sin are you willing to get? And such that we could get you to a place where you're just sort of, you're close enough that you're definitely still on the not sinning side, but a gust of wind might make you trip over your shoelace and might make you tip over into there. So that you're really feeling that, because that's what you've been running away from, is your willingness to feel that uncertainty. And that's really what I'm interested in, not just, did he think about the devil, or, did he touch something dirty?
No, that's great. That's really interesting, because a lot of people say they get pushed too far too soon. So it's good to hear you kind of testing that line. And as it, what you said about, there's not a lot of people specifically specialized in OCD, and that seems to be the main complaint, not complaint, but it's the main worry I get from people, is they find it hard to find someone who's trained in OCD. They can find people who are trained in CBT, but even a lot of CBT therapists still don't have their finger on the pulse when it comes to OCD. Not to knock them, they're great in their own right, and but obviously OCD is its own beast. So it's, I agree, people need to spend that time.
I think like a good example is you could have a trained CBT specialist who works mostly, let's say, with depression, for which CBT is very effective, and they may try to use some of the same cognitive interventions for OCD because it would be logical. but then finding that it backfires because it's just functioning as a self-reassurance mental ritual.
Yeah.
So they may be encouraging people to, you know, put a positive spin on their scary thoughts, which would work if their scary thoughts were existed solely within the depressive construct.
Yeah.
But the OCD is a way of taking advantage of that, and that becomes a thought neutralization, which then actually makes the obsession worse. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's improving. I think we're seeing more trainings come up. The IOCDF offers their Behavioral Training Institute, and I think there's more trainings happening in part because there's more people interested in getting trained, and in part because there are more people with OCD who are being vocal about, you know, I want to do the work, I want to get better, but my insurance company sent me to this guy, and what am I supposed to do, you know?
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. We have obviously the NHS here in the UK, and they're amazing. Like, if you get physically sick, they're wonderful and they're free. But with mental illness, there's less funding in that area. But I've had people who have said they did like 2 years of talk therapy, because I don't think this isn't necessarily linked to the NHS. This could be private as well, but they did 2 years of talk therapy because the therapist didn't spot that it was OCD. And I hear that so many times. And they're not CBT trained. They're just, you know, regular therapists. I don't know what they're trained in. But yeah, it's scary to think that. Yeah. Anyway, I don't want to knock any therapists, really, because obviously. But yeah, that just seems to be a concern I get. Something that came up in your book that I found really interesting was this idea of an acceptance script.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously there's imaginal exposure where you write down your biggest and worst fears and keep rereading it or listening to it until it becomes boring and you no longer fear it. But obviously for some people that's too far, it's too extreme, it's too scary. Could you explain what the acceptance script is and how it could be a nice alternative or to ease into it?
Yeah, sure. So it's actually since working on the mindfulness workbook, it's evolved a bit in my mind. The way I do it now is slightly different from the way it's written there. But the idea is that this is an acceptance and motivation script. So it's basically saying, look, here's what's going on. This is the way that things are. Let's be honest with ourselves. This is a conversation between you and your mind, basically.
Yeah.
Like, let's be honest about what we're up against and stop pretending that there's like a number of compulsions that's going to work, or that there's like a eureka moment. If I just review this a little bit more, I'm going to be like, aha, and it's just going to disappear. Let's make our peace with the fact that that is never going to happen. And look for a rationale for doing the hard work it takes to actually master your OCD, to actually get stronger than your OCD. So I break it down into four parts, four questions, rather. Question number one, what are you going to change? So this basically means, you know, what compulsions are you going to stop doing? Now, this doesn't mean that because you wrote that, like that day, you're going to stop doing all your compulsions, but you're just, again, you're being open and honest about the way things are. You know, I'm going to stop trying to find out if I am going to harm my children, right? That's something that you need to stop doing because you've been doing it for all these years and it hasn't produced results, right? I'm going to start cooking in the kitchen with knives even though I have these thoughts about hurting myself, you know, or hurting people with knives, you know. And just paint a picture of what it would look like if you weren't a slave to the OCD.
Yeah.
And then you go into question two, which is what unwanted consequences might occur as a result of making these changes. And I always tell them, you know, make it capital letters, underline the word might. We're talking about uncertainty here. We're talking about potential because we don't know, right? And so, you know, if you wash your hands every time you touch a doorknob because you think you're going to get some sort of terrible disease, and then you stop washing your hands because it's ruining your life, in theory anyway, the likelihood of you catching this mythical terrible disease has gone up, you know, maybe from 1 in a trillion to, you know, 1.1 in a trillion.
Yeah.
And you're not going to like that. you know? So you have to, again, this is be honest about your experience. I'm going to stop doing these compulsions. And as a result of that, my fears may come true. And I may be stuck with this, and I may be stuck with that, and I may have to deal with this and that, and it could be very bad indeed. And so this is the scary part of the script that shares the most in common with what you might call a flooding script, where the purpose really is to generate fear and be in the presence of that fear. This isn't quite as hardcore as that, because you're saying it could happen.
Yeah.
And the truth is, any statement that starts with the word maybe is objectively true. You know, we don't like this, people with OCD. We really don't, but it's just the truth, right? Maybe, you know, the ceiling is going to fall on my head in the middle of this interview. That is an objectively true statement.
Yeah.
Now, I don't have any reason to think that it will fall on my head, and I'm not going to take the time to, like, go and, like, investigate and sort of take the blueprints and make sure that the architect knew what he was doing. You know, just because something's possible doesn't mean it's worth a lot or even any of your attention.
Yeah.
But you have to be honest. If it starts with the word maybe, it's an objectively fair statement.
Yeah.
And again, so you're just owning that in this script. I'm going to stop doing these things. I'm going to start doing these other things. And it may result in something very bad indeed. Question number three, what is probably going to happen if you don't change these behaviors? And this is where, this is sort of like the big reveal in the movie where you think you knew who the bad guy was and then you realize, oh no, he's the bad guy. Yeah. Because here's where you can say, here's where you can describe the volume knob on the OCD going up, because that's the truth, right? Yeah. If you don't do something about your OCD, the natural trajectory is for it to get worse, not better, because you're constantly reinforcing the obsession with your compulsions. So what's it going to look like if you keep washing your hands this much, if you keep doing all this mental review and avoiding being social and connecting with your family because you're in your head all the time? Right? Well, okay, so describe that in as much detail as you can about what it's like to live with that pain and that anxiety and that depression and to not be able to achieve the things that you really care about and to look back on your life and wonder whether or not you wasted it or you could have gotten better. So question number three is really what's probably going to happen if you continue to obey the OCD and continue to be a slave to the OCD?
Yeah.
And that pretty much sets the stage for the final question, which is, you know, wow, you know, why is it worth it? You know, why is it worth it to do the hard work of getting better? And you pretty much just laid it out because it's, you don't have a choice.
Yeah.
You know, you have to get better because you know, there are things that you care about. There are people that you care about. There are things that you value. So the sort of subtext of that question is, you know, what is it that you care about that would make it worth it to take the risk that, you know, maybe you'll get sick or maybe you'll die or maybe you'll find out that you're a horrible human being? Why would you take that risk? Well, because the alternative is far worse and far more likely to occur if you don't do that. And so when you finish reading this script, the sentiment that we're going for is, I'm going to go out into the world now and I'm going to be mindful of my triggers and mindful of my urges to do compulsions, and I'm going to give it my best shot. I'm really going to try to change my behavior because I really want to get better. So it's meant as a motivator. It's not super fun, you know. It's definitely a softer approach than a flooding script, but it's really about pointing yourself in a direction. And I would have somebody read that script once a day, you know, in the morning, maybe twice a day or something like that. The goal isn't to habituate to it and to find it boring. The goal is to actually bring it to the forefront of your mind and say, all right, I'm going to make these changes. They may not go my way. If I don't make these changes, I'm looking at a world of hurt that I find unacceptable. So it's worth it.
Yeah.
And that's what you're thinking, is I'm worth it.
Yeah, no, that's really inspiring. And points three and four of that exercise could definitely be applied to someone who's scared to do ERP. Because I always say to them, you know, it's terrifying doing ERP, but what's more terrifying is spending your life giving in to OCD. It's just because you're comfortable with it doesn't mean it's better. But
people with OCD are also very very quick to disqualify the positives, right? To not give themselves credit, because everybody who's saying I want to do ERP but I'm too scared, they're already doing ERP a lot. They just don't know it. I mean, every time they do something that they want, despite the OCD, they're doing ERP. They're just not taking any credit for it.
Yeah.
It's very rare anyway that I would come across a client who is not already, that doesn't already kind of get it, you know, that they can't keep taking, you know, getting bullied by the OCD if they want to do anything.
Yeah.
You know, like I wanted to go to the movies with my friends, but I started to have a panic attack and, but I went anyway. You know, they're not going to call that ERP, but yeah. What is it, right? It's going to a big, dark, scary room where you can't immediately escape and allowing yourself to have horrible feelings because you want to go to the movies with your friends and you're tired of taking it from the OCD.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's brilliant. That's really interesting. So with the acceptance script, do you see that that really helps motivate people? Do you get a lot of good feedback from your clients on that one?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. And it just kind of, you know, they get bored with it after a while because they, you know, they don't need it, you know, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, that is. Yeah, it's worked. All right, cool. So there's four things in your book and I'm going to throw them all at you at once. I hope your memory's good. That I just found really interesting. And I just wondered if you could kind of explain them. And I guess any additional info. So it's a very vague question, but the four things were mental reviewing, scenario bending, mental rehearsal, and memory hoarding.
Mm-hmm.
So just going through them, I don't know why, but they just really intrigued me. I think because especially I could relate to all of them. Most notably mentally reviewing with harm obsessions. Mental rehearsal as well, again, with harm obsessions. And there's a point on memory hoarding I want to touch on in a bit, but I just want to get your take on that.
Yeah, so a lot of these terms are, you know, they're just invented. They're just they're ways of describing an experience. And quite often you hear people using the word obsessing as the equivalent of doing mental review, but it's not really true. Mental review is a behavior, so it's a compulsion. Obsessing is just being on the receiving end of unwanted and intrusive thoughts. You know, compulsing is you know your strategy for neutralizing or suppressing or getting rid of those thoughts. And mental review, I think, is the most overlooked compulsion. And I think there are a lot of people out there who are, you know, not getting properly diagnosed by people who just aren't trained to diagnose OCD. Because they say, well, you know, you don't wash your hands, so you know, probably we're just going to call it generalized anxiety disorder or something. You know, And the thing is, mental review is often the most time consuming, the most psychologically damaging behavior that we do because we get so caught up in it. So it's literally, you know, to me, think about what reviewing is, right? Re meaning again, view meaning taking a look at, right? So you're taking a look at the same thing over and over and over and over again, trying to sort of push it out the same year that it came in, you know, trying to resolve it, destroy it, shrink it. You know, you're not letting it go through you in the mindfulness sense. You're actually stopping it and you're saying, no, there's, you know, get back out there. And that's what's causing you all of your pain. Mm-hmm. And it's, the OCD is such a liar, right? Because it keeps dangling this carrot in front of you and saying, you know, you're so close. If you just think about it a little bit harder, you're going to have it figured out and then you're just going to feel so good. You're going to be so rewarded. You know, that's your paradise. If you just give it like a little bit more and then you'll get the answer and then you'll get better. And you think you're getting there and you think you're getting there and you think you're getting there. And then you think you've gotten there. And the OCD says, yeah, nice effort. But you know, what about this? And it just raised the bar. You can't do that. That's unfair, right? Yeah. And then you go right back to work. What people often ask me if because I you know I'm somehow have it's become known that I work a lot in this sort of mental ritual world, and people often ask me is that harder than treating, let's say, a compulsive hand washer or a stove checker or something like that? And it actually, in my opinion, is not harder, and the reason is that a lot of the physical compulsions that we see are basically strategies that are backup strategies to mental compulsions. So the mental compulsions haven't done enough, you know. So if reduced contamination OCD, by the time that person's gone to the sink to wash, they've already done a significant amount of mental review trying to convince themselves that they're clean, but it didn't work. So then they go and they wash. If it had worked, they'd say, okay, no, I don't need to wash because I touched this thing and I know that thing isn't going to hurt me because of this and that.
Yeah.
So very often it's, you know, we got to target the physical compulsions and get them out of the picture so we can get to work on the real problem, which is you doing battle in your head. So mental review, again, is just going over the same thing, going over some concept, and trying to get certainty about it in the hopes that that will make it go away. And there are different kinds of mental review. So you mentioned one, my personal favorite, which I've come to call scenario bending, which again, that doesn't actually mean anything. This is the only way I could describe, you know, what's happening. Because I would see clients do this. And I'd say, well, we need a name for this. And what it is you have an obsessive thought that you either did or could or would engage in some sort of unacceptable behavior. Some immoral behavior, sexual behavior, violent behavior.
Yeah.
And you tell yourself a story that didn't happen of what could or would have happened, right? So an example might be, would I have cheated on my wife if this woman in my office came on to me, right? So that's a thing that didn't happen. But if it did happen, it starts to sound very political. It starts to sound like a debate, like a presidential debate, I'm not saying that, this candidate is a terrible human being, but if he were a terrible human being, let's talk about that for a little bit. This is the way it kind of sets you up. So if this person hits on me, would I cheat on my wife? And the obsession is that I'm a bad person, that I'm not moral, and I need to know that I wouldn't cheat on my wife. So what I'm going to do is play this image over and over in my head of being hit on and try to convince myself that I would say, no, get away from me, pretty lady, And it is, maybe that's the truth, right?
Yeah.
But it's, of course, unknowable because the whole thing is fiction.
Yeah.
And you either get to a place where you've reassured yourself that everything's fine, which really just makes you more sensitive to the obsession because now you have to do that every time it comes up.
Yeah.
Or you get to some, worse place where you've convinced yourself, I really am a terrible human being. And then you just have more and more tests that you have to run to see how horrible a human being you think you are. So I've worked with people who spend hours and hours a day doing this, just running through fictional scenarios that they haven't experienced but think that they might or could one day, and then asking themselves, did I do the right thing?
Yeah.
That's really got to be, that's so far removed from mindfulness. I mean, that's really following the thoughts down the rabbit hole.
Yeah.
The other one you mentioned was mental rehearsal, which is just, kind of reviewing imagined future scenarios, but not in this sort of, in a somewhat less hypothetical way. So it would be, playing out conversations that you're planning to have. It would be an example of mental rehearsal to make sure that you're going to do it the right way.
Yeah, that plagued me a lot as well. I think that still does a little bit, actually, and the mental reviewing from a harm OCD point of view. But obviously, I'm a lot better at pushing it out. One thing I wanted to touch on with memory hoarding, which was the next one. So with one of my harm obsessions, which still sticks around a little bit, which I'm slowly loosening its grip on me. The particular obsession is around. It's overlaying stories on the past, and OCD's questioning, but what if this? What happens if your attentions were this? What happens actually if this happened and this is how it played out, not in the way your original memory went, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And at times I then get all the way to the future where, okay, now this thing's come back at the past and I'm in court and I have to defend myself. Mm-hmm. And I'm almost keeping hold of that evidence and memory for when I need it in the future. This is what my brain. So would that be considered memory hoarding? Because I'm trying to.
Yeah, I think it would. That's the first time I've heard it put in quite those terms, within the concept of memory hoarding. But that's exactly what you're doing, right?
Yeah.
Why do people hoard physical items? Usually what you hear is, I might need it one day, this article or something like that. Or sometimes it's, because I'm emotionally attached to it or something like that. But in this case, it's, saving a memory because you think it might be important. And for some people, it might be important simply because they think, well, I'm going to want to reflect on this. I mean, it might be a good thing,
yeah.
But they're not really having the experience. They're sort of living behind a mental camera. So they're at, you know, their wedding or they're at their graduation or something like that. And all they're really doing is trying to collect data so that they can enjoy it later, as if, like you would if you were holding a video camera,
yeah.
Instead of just being in the moment and experiencing it and taking the risk that maybe tomorrow you'd wake up and not really remember much of it at all. And in the case that you're describing, it's that mix between memory hoarding and scenario bending, right? You're imagining that there's this sort of trial in the future where they're saying, you know, we accuse you of having done this terrible thing, and then you're able to open up this case file, and in the case file are memories of you not being at the scene of the crime, you know, memories of you doing something else, and you're going to want to be able to say, no, I know for a fact that, you know, I wasn't there when this horrible thing happened, and I have no history of doing these horrible things, and I never would, and here's the evidence. It's my perfectly pristine, protected memories. But of course, it has the opposite effect, which is, you know, like any thought, if you cling to it too tightly, it kind of, you know, it gets bent, you know, basically, and then you're left with something that doesn't feel like the truth.
Yeah.
So if you keep reminding yourself of something that you already know, what is the brain getting? And this is a question you want to ask yourself all the time when you're doing compulsions. What is my brain getting out of this experience? Because at the end of the day, your brain's going to have to calculate what that meant, right? If I avoid something, my brain's going to say that thing you avoided must have been dangerous. You know, it could be a you know, whatever. It could be a brown piece of paper or something. It would be irrelevant. And still, your brain's like, yeah, you should stay away from that because you've been staying away from that. So there must be something up with that. Yeah. And it's the same thing with memory hoarding. It's you know, you keep telling yourself that you were definitely here at 3:59 p.m. and not over there, you know, molesting a child or something. Mm. And you keep saying it over and over again. You must not be so sure, right? Yeah. You must need reminders, yeah. Right? And you go, oh, well, maybe it's 3:57, you know, and you're right back where you started from.
Yeah.
It's a very, very frustrating experience. And the more you review your memories, the more distorted they become.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's great. And it's definitely like mindfulness that helps me in acceptance through those times, although they are weakening. Okay, so... what, obviously there's many things, but you know, if you had to give one piece of advice that someone with OCD could implement today that would make their life a little bit better, what would that be?
Oh, that's a hard one. One piece of advice. Yeah, I think I answered this question in another interview once, and I checked it out. I said something like, never settle for just one piece of advice. That's my one piece of advice. Is that, and what I mean by that actually is, don't be afraid to collect bits and pieces of information from all over and use it to your advantage. You know, this is war here, you and your OCD. So use all the weapons that you have.
Yeah.
You know, get help if you have access to it. Reach out for support if you have people in your life that care about you and that you trust. And give yourself, you know, maybe something I can add to this answer is, in terms of that one piece of advice, give yourself some credit. It actually is as hard as you think, but you are stronger than you know.
Yeah.
And the tendency here is to, you know, because we're so performance oriented, is to punish ourselves a lot and to say really unkind, non-compassionate things to ourselves about how messed up we are, how sick or crazy we are. Mm. And punishment doesn't work. It just makes you feel bad and then it makes you less motivated to take care of yourself.
Yeah.
What really works is being a good coach, which is to say, start with compassion. Oh, wow, this is really hard. I see you're having a hard time out there.
Yeah.
And then give yourself a direction. All right, now get back out there and score a goal. Come on, you can do this.
Yeah, that's really good advice. I think, yeah, OCD sufferers need to be more compassionate on themselves. Yeah, it's brilliant. Okay, cool. Do you have any more books in the pipeline?
Well, so we've been talking about the mindfulness workbook. In December, When a Family Member Has OCD came out, and I feel really good about it. I've gotten a lot of positive feedback from a lot of great therapists were willing to endorse it and had some nice things to say about it. And I'm just starting to see the user reviews trickle in on Amazon, and people seem to get it. And I think what I'm really proud of with that book is that I wrote it thinking, even though it's a book for family members and they're sort of the target audience, I wrote it thinking about an OCD sufferer reading it and saying, all right, I think I could show this to my mom, or, you know, I think I could show this to my wife. So it's very much sort of an empathy guide for the loved ones. So that's out. And then I just found out just a few days ago that I'm going to be co-writing a book with Shala Nicely, who's an OCD specialist therapist in Georgia. And she was the keynote speaker at the OCD Foundation's conference in 2013. And we're going to write a book together. It doesn't have a title quite yet, but it's something along the lines of Living Joyfully with OCD. And the premise of the book is that this is a long-term management guide for actually living with this thing. Because we have lots of books about, you know, how to get treatment and how to do exposure therapy and things like that. And it'll have some elements of this, but really this book will be about how to set up some, mindfulness tools and exposure tools and just philosophical strategies for actually living with this thing, living long term, and seeing it as a process of long term mastery, and not just go get a therapist and then get better and stop having OCD, because it is a bit more complicated than that.
No, I really like that, the whole idea of kind of living the good life in spite of OCD. That's no, that's brilliant. Would that be a 2017 release, do you think?
Yes, I think spring of 2017 is the plan.
Cool. All right, well, we'll definitely get you back on to promote that and talk about it.
Oh, thanks.
Cool. So, all right, so a bit off the wall question. It doesn't have to be OCD related, but you can have a billboard anywhere you want in the world, doesn't matter, but what would you have on that billboard? What message would you have written on it?
If you can read this, keep your eyes on the road. I don't know. I don't know. I feel like only very sort of trite sounding things are coming to mind, but they're so important. You know, things, I think it'd be nice to see a billboard that had just a very simple motivational statements on it. We just sort of put them around cities, you know, things like, you could do this. Don't be so hard on yourself. You know, this too shall pass, you know, all things are impermanent. So I don't know if I have a great answer for you.
No, that's probably, really good.
Probably some version of, all right, that's enough of that. Now dust yourself off and get back to it.
Yeah. All right, brilliant. So how can people get in touch with you and find out more about the work you're doing?
So they can contact me through my website, which is ocdbaltimore.com.
Yeah.
I'm on Twitter, which is twitter.com/CBTOCD. I'm on Facebook, John Hirschfield. I'm very email accessible, I've been told. I spend a lot of time responding to emails. I love it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what got me into this. So I continue to do it. So I continue to moderate the Pure O OCD Yahoo group that has about 3,000 members.
Wow.
And I occasionally contributed to OCD Support, where Dr. Claiborne writes, which I think has about 5,000 or 6,000 members. So jonathanhirschfield@gmail.com is my email address.
Cool.
So I'm pretty accessible.
You might regret saying that.
Yes, I know. Perhaps.
All right, brilliant. Yeah, thank you so much for your time and some phenomenal answers. And I know people are going to get a lot out of this. Hopefully there's some therapists listening. They might have got some stuff out of it as well. But yeah, thank you so much. We'll definitely get you on for a part 2, part 3.
I would love it. This has been a great experience, and thanks for inviting me.
Cool, no, pleasure, John. Cheers.
All right, take care.
Cheers.
Bye.